The following podcast has been recorded under the influence of alcohol. While not intentionally offensive, things are said, feelings may be hurt, and f**ks are not given. Clearly, it's the beer's fault. Welcome, everyone, to Good Beer, Bad Movie Night, the podcast dedicated to movies of questionable quality and the frosty adult beverages that help make them tolerable. It is episode number 39, and being the month of July, this is our independent month. Stars and stripes. Okay. So, anyway, with the independent month, we usually choose a film from an independent filmmaker. In the past, we've done Christopher R. Mim and Josh Kennedy, but this month, for shits and giggles, we have chosen three shorts to review for your listening pleasure. We have a cartoon short from Mark Bailey and Foxtrot Studios called It Came from the East River. We have a college product from a nephew-in-law of mine, or nephew once removed, something like that. I'm not real sure. Anyway, it's called Candyland. And then finally, a Kickstarter that we backed that actually went through, got made, and we got our DVD a couple months ago, maybe like January, December, something like that.
I had completely forgotten that we had Kickstarter, yeah.
Yeah, our name's in the credits. We are in the credits. So the Kickstarter.
Troy went past him too fast. And I was like, wait, what are you doing? We got to watch the credits.
That's why we paid our money, damn it. But this is called, this is a Japanese Bunraku kaiju film short thing called Howl from Beyond the Fog. And I've got some stories to tell about it later on. But before we do any of that, let's talk to our guest. My name is not guests. I said that wrong. So sorry.
Have a guest?
I'm so sorry.
This is hard enough to set up when it's just us.
I'm flying by the seat of my pants. I do not have my script in front of me. So my name is Pete. The rest of my lovely hosts I see on the meeting here. Kathleen, how are you, love?
I'm doing okay. We went to the zoo today, so.
Neato. All the animals were wearing masks, I assume.
They were not, but they had a large portion of North American zookeeper in there, so.
That's right. alongside Kathleen, we have Dave. How are you, Dave?
I'm doing great. Well, good, well, whatever. I'm all right. I'm good.
All the above is acceptable. Thank you so very much. Troy, how's it going down there?
I'm doing fine. Just to distinguish Dave.
I see you have your scary monster behind you. Your secret dinosaur.
I do.
Yes. Tippy.
What's his name again?
Tippy.
Tippy. That's right.
Yeah.
You want? Have we described Tippy to the fan or
yes,
the listener?
Yes. We went on about Tippy at length, like for a long time. I actually had to cut a lot of it out. Almost all of it.
Tippy's pretty damn entertaining. So.
Tippy is terrifying to a degree.
Yeah, well, apparently he has terrified Troy many times.
Yes. I got a good scream out of Millie when I put him back in the shower again. So.
Oh, so good.
Yeah. That was
so
good.
Evil. So
that
good.
Was the first time that, like, when we first got him, we did that. And then, I don't know, it's been a few
And then we
months,
revisited the old
again.
Classic
yeah.
and bam.
Worked, that old chestnut.
Still hangs in there.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead, Dave. I'm sorry.
Since we're doing kind of an anthology, three different shorts, I'm assuming there's not going to be a 6-minute synopsis.
No, sir. No prepared 6-minute synopsis. But we'll talk about each film as we hit them in between beer breaks, which, as a matter of fact, I think is a very good time to take one right now. We will be right back.
All right.
Do, 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 do.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get our
ourselves a treat.
That sounds like beer.
Catawba Island Brewing.
We've been there.
Have we?
Catawba, yeah. Catawba's, Catawba Island Brewery is not actually on Catawba. Shh.
Lies.
It's right, right. So Catawba Brewing, I think, yeah, they had the really cool tables. Do you remember the those big, long, like, driftwood tables?
Kind of. Did they bring us either food or something in buckets?
No, no food there.
Okay. I'm thinking of someplace else. I'm thinking of the place that we went where you guys got oysters and they were in buckets.
Oh, yeah. Do you
give it food or something in buckets?
That's Krabby Joe's. It is a tiny little place, but it's really, really pretty. They've got a beautiful stainless steel setup. They've got these great big long driftwood tables that somebody locally makes. They used to have a whole bunch of pinball machines. And they no longer have pinball machines. Everybody's making faces now. Fuck you.
I'm smelling the beer.
I was making a face at Dave's face.
So anyway, this one's called Lake Erie Love, and it is the take on a Kolsch beer. And a Kolsch beer is a unique style of German beer where it is... okay, so it uses a hybrid yeast that... It's a lager beer. It's made like a lager beer, but it uses an ale yeast, which means it can be fermented at a higher temperature. So you don't need to lager it over the winter at a colder temperature. Blah, blah, blah. Beer nerd stuff. It's basically, it's a hybrid beer.
I think we've talked about this before.
We may have. Yeah, I think you're right.
Where we talked about, like, putting things in the cave for the winter and then doing something different in the summer.
All right.
Maybe you put it in the cave in the summer because the cave is cooler. I don't remember, but we definitely had a whole conversation about brewing beer in
caves. A cave was involved.
Yeah. Right, right. Or cellars or, yeah, whatever. All the above. It's a different way to make a lager because it's made with an ale yeast at a higher temperature. So that's the basis of what this is. It is supposed to be cleaner and crisper than a lot of your ales. This one,
and it has that nice ale taste to it.
It's got a bready, maybe that's bready yeasty. That's I'm getting a lot of bready and yeasty, but I'm also getting a very clean and noble hop, much like any classic lager would have, like a Czech Pils would have this sort of sock smelly. Foot smelly hop. That's
when I first opened it, that might be a bad descriptor.
Right,
let me back up on that one.
Well, when I first opened it, I thought, socks it smells a little funky.
Yeah.
But that's kind of dissipated a little bit, and now it's got a little bit of sweet to it. It's because it's got that even not a lot of taste lagerness, but there is a sweetness behind it, and you're right, a breadiness. That's a good description for that.
Mm-hmm.
I like this, actually.
You know what? I don't know what it is about this particular beer, but when I opened it and I smelled it, when I poured it and I smelled it, I somehow got a hit of childhood. Don't ask me why it reminds me of childhood.
Why does it remind you of childhood?
I told you not to ask me that.
Oh, sorry.
Well done. That's a good bit. Do that again.
I know. I did have my first beer when I was about three. Apparently, one of my uncles decided it'd be hilarious to give little Dave a beer, and then
a whole beer or a sip.
I don't know how much I drank. I was three.
Oh God!
And however much I drank, probably about 20 minutes later, like little red-faced Dave, 3 years old, was scrambling around, and then passed out.
And then so definitely the more than a sip.
2 days later, they found me 2 counties away. But shagging up with a hooker named Rhonda.
It's
Rhonda.
Rhonda, what are you doing with this 3-year-old?
He moved in and wouldn't leave.
No, but it does smell like the beers that my uncles, my older uncles, and my father would drink when I was a kid. I don't know what they drank. I think it was stuff like this. It was like this or Heineken or
maybe Stroh's.
Stroh's, yeah.
It's Lats. Yeah.
It smells like a beer that was popular in the 80s.
So you're talking uncles from Northeast Ohio. Would there be like maybe some Genesee up there?
Oh no, this is when I grew up in South Carolina.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sort of back then. But I don't know. There's something kind of nostalgic about the smell. And I don't think it was from when I was drunk at 3, but
it's possible.
It may have scarred you for life, Dan.
Shaped you in a way you had no real idea. So many things making sense now.
But yeah, I got this specifically because we're reminiscing since it's July, and it's been so long since we've been up at the lake, and we should be up there right now doing the podcast. That'd be so much fun. And we used to spend a week up there, up on Put-in Bay, and those are some of the best memories I have from my young adulthood, where I should not have been spending that much money and all sorts of. Certainly not drinking that much. Although if you don't drink that much when you're that young, it's just creepy when you're in your 40s.
Well, we never drove. And we took rests
true.
On the side of the road when we couldn't walk back. I'm not naming any names.
Oh, you've got to. You had to have a mean drunk on when you're too drunk to walk and you have to stop walking.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
just sleep a little bit.
I didn't sleep. We just took a rest.
Just I was wrapped in my eyes.
No, my eyes were open the whole time.
We picked mulberries in the morning, make pancakes.
That was not me.
That was me. I loved that.
I know it was.
That was fun. Anyway.
There's nothing quite like drunk mulberry picking.
there's nothing quite like drunk putt-putt.
Oh, my God.
That's a good time. And 18 holes of putt-putt is too long for a bunch of drunk shitheads.
Especially when it's historically themed and every hole like has like a paragraph about the battle.
I'm trying to read.
And we have to read it before we can do the putt-putt hole for that one.
Oh, I could see that now.
It's not
like,
good.
This is where Old Ironsides, the USS Constitution, was sailing in Lake Erie in the Battle of the War of 1812. And everybody's like, I don't.
It's the War of 1812.
Oliver Hatchard, who?
You are right.
Exactly. This is where Commodore Perry first started to pick taking up crochet or whatever.
Made his own flag.
But I think it's great when beverages or food like have really strong ties and associations with memories.
Oh, totally.
Like, you have memories of Lake Erie, Catawba Island, Put-in Bay. And this beer, and I apparently have memories of when I was 3, and my parents just watching me running around, going like, "Oh, well, that's permanent."
They're like, "Never have I thought I could see into the future, and now I can."
Maybe it was all the paint chips I ate as a kid.
Oh, as long as they weren't lead paint chips, you'd be all right.
Oh, is that bad?
You tell me, Troy.
Well.
All right, so let's get into this. Since, again, Independent Month, this is something we haven't done before, so we're kind of shooting from the hip here.
Pew, mm-hmm. Pew.
Our first... pew, pew, pew. So our first selection tonight comes from our buddy, Troy, you remember this guy, Mark Bailey. We interviewed him way back on episode of Good Beer, Bad Movie Night.
Oh, those were the good old days. They
were, weren't
back
they?
Back on when the we episode.
So he's a cartoonist, and he has a website called FoxtrotStudios.net. He does flash clip art animations, and they're adorable.
If I remember
hilarious.
Right, he said that he just starts one at the beginning of the year, works on it for the rest of the year. At the end of the year, wherever it's at, he's considered that one's done, and he does the next one. If I remember
right.
him saying that.
It's a goal of his to have one out every year, so you can get onto his website, and it's all free, and it's a lot of fun. However, the one we're reviewing tonight, It Came from the East River, is a multi-award winner. It has won the Amateur Film Contest from G-Fest 2018, which is where he and I met. It has won third place at the Art Exhibition Contest, Multimedia and Motion Graphics, Southern New Hampshire University Online 2020. I'd like to see the trophy for that one. It probably wraps around a few times. and he just most recently won for Best Animated Film in the Turnpike Film Festival 2020.
Very
cool.
So
this 3-minute-ish short has won multiple awards, and I thought it was adorable. What did you guys think of It Came from the East River?
I liked it. I liked the kind of throwback to the silent era movies with the black screens with text on them to move the story along, and the kind of
kind of music
that went with it.
That was adorable.
Yeah. I liked that. And I liked the depth that you got in the sense of he'd have like a character on screen, and then like somebody would like walk by, and this other little cartoon would just like walk past, you know, like in foreground or whatever, to like, so it's like a very layered look. I thought it was cool.
It was in three dimensions. It wasn't just the person that the camera was focused on. There was stuff happening in the background, and that was really special. If you had the watchful eye and you saw the guy burn up out behind the police officer calling in to ask for backup or something.
Yeah. I like the concept of he works on it for a year, and where it's at, it's done. So, you know, if he's got this very specific story he wants to tell, you know, that's going to push him to make sure he gets to a certain point in the length or is able to tell enough of the story within the parameters of working on it for a year. But that he's also willing to just be like, and done. Okay, this is where it's at.
Done.
And, you know, almost make that a point of, like, growth moving forward. Like, I had more of a story, or I wanted to do more with that, and, you know, I didn't make it. So I screwed around. I have to change, you know, my thought process coming to that. And I'm not saying that he's ever done that, but that's what setting a parameter like that will do.
There's a couple of moments, sure, like, I don't understand what's going on on this one.
If you go through his, yeah, there are some very complete stories, and there are some very, like, good enough. But I think Mark would admit that, too. He's a good spirit. I like at the end of this one, after the credits, there's a big question mark. Dun, dun, dun. Maybe there will be It Came from the West River.
Oh, yeah.
I think the East River is actually a reference to the East River in New York.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
So maybe he'll choose the other, like, It Came from the Hudson River.
There you go.
Oh, we have friends on the Hudson River, don't we, Kathleen?
Yes, way up north. Yeah,
way up north. Right.
Oh. No, I liked the movie. I also liked that it was a kind of an homage to the silent film era, and like the single piano accompaniment. Mm-hmm. And I like how they had the plan to attack the monster, and then it ended up involving zeppelins and like these flying machines.
Yes,
and
that's flying bicycles. My favorite part.
Yeah, I thought that was cute. And it looked like a kind of a big Loch Ness monster, Nessie, Brontosaurus kind of thing, which I also thought was cute. The only thing I found confusing was at the end, spoiler alert, sorry, eventually the monster gets hooked by an anchor, like, or by the neck, and then you see that there's another monster, a lady monster of some kind. And I couldn't figure out if that lady monster was, like, the owner of the small monster, the Loch Ness monster, like, and it was reapplying a leash, or if it was like a lady counterpart to the monster that we now find out is male.
I took it as, because the monster kind of looked like a giant cat snake.
Mm-hmm. Yes, this is what I thought too.
That breathed fire. But wow. let me I need
I
to
breathe fire.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry,
but it was like a giant cat snake,
and
the anchor was like the leash, and the woman at the end was the owner of the cat.
That's what I got.
That was my interpretation.
Right.
Yeah, I interpreted it as, because I actually had that in my notes, is that the dragon looks like. I called it a dragon, the monster. That looked like a cat, and then the mermaid lady monster thing at the end seemed like annoyed, like, oh, you stupid cat got out again, and then, like, you know, get back in here. So,
I mean, so, that's I mean, it to destroy a city, I would be annoyed too. I mean, all my cat does is just diarrhea on my living room carpet.
Oh my god, I think I'd rather let it out to destroy the city than deal with that.
Please burn the house down before you diarrhea in my living room carpet.
Cats. Evil.
So I want to thank Mark for sharing his art with us. That was it. I go back every once in a while and just giggle my way through his cartoons. And we'll put the link to his website in the show notes so you all can go enjoy it also. He also has a really cool, it's a New York City monster map where all these giant monsters have landed in New York City. Yes. And you can follow them where like where? Cloverfield hit, where Godzilla 98 hit, where all these other Quetzalcoatl was, where he's got King Kong a number of times.
Yeah. He's got this Stay Puft Marshmallow Man.
Oh, yes, I think that's one of them also. It's a hoot. So
it's every location in New York where a monster is attacked. That's
a lot of fun. Yeah, it's an interactive map. It's a blast.
That's cool.
Yeah, I've looked through it. I've clicked through it. It is a lot of fun, and a lot of time was spent on it. There's a lot of detail.
Mm-hmm. There really is. So thank you, Mark. We appreciate it. Friend of the show. We hope to talk to you again soon.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
Our next short tonight is an independent film from a college out in Boston, Massachusetts, called Candyland Part 1. It's from 2019. We will provide a link in the show notes for you to watch this. Calm Donson is a nephew-in-law of mine. He is my sister's husband's nephew. And you can do the math on that. I don't care. Anyway, he is now a sophomore at Emerson College in Boston, Massachusetts. He started this as a freshman. And he's going to Emerson College in Boston for filmmaking. He wrote and directed this short. He was also part of the executive producer team, which means they probably mowed lawns and
sold candy bars.
We think could have sold candy bars. Indeed. Oh, that's very
scandalous.
Meta. So Candyland is a college project for them, and their Indiegogo for part two has ended, and it must have ended recently because I was going to give him some money and it closed. So anyway, I was hoping
is it going to Indiegogo?
It was funded. So
it went.
When will it Indy return turn?
I don't know. These are college kids. Who knows what's going on? Anyway,
they've already spent all the money on beer.
Maybe.
Indy spent.
So again, Colm's a sophomore at Emerson College. One of the cool things is his brother Brogan did a lot of the props, and my sister pointed out specifically that he designed the candy cane gun in the film. So I'm like, that's really cool. And his brother Brogan is a junior or senior in high school. So I think as a junior in high school, he designed a bunch of the props. He and a couple other guys were prop designers. And so that's really cool. And these kids are out there doing it. So I'm really proud of them and what they've done. And I've held off watching this because I knew we were going to cover it one of these days. And I'm embarrassed to say that I should not have wasted time and I should have watched it right away. It was great. Anyway, Candyland takes place in a world where processed sugar has been banned from public consumption. And our protagonist, Mike, or Michael, as they call him, turns to dealing candy to pay for his college.
Right. Sugar has become an illicit substance.
Correct. So, yeah. Right. So that's the story that we follow Mike. And I don't know, guys. I thoroughly enjoyed this. It was an absolute ball to watch. Are they amateurs? You're damn right. But I've seen a lot of professionals that do much worse job than these kids are doing. Much worse. So, Troy, what did you think about Candyland?
It was fun. I enjoyed it. The acting was actually pretty good. I was quite impressed by everybody's performance. I like all the little jokes that they hid and like Michael's partner's Ike, so they're Mike and Ike.
Right.
Nice.
Oh my god, I did not catch that.
Ah! Yeah, exactly.
I didn't catch it either, Dave, because I actually thought that when Ike introduces himself, he has the unfortunateness of his line is "I'm Ike," so he doesn't. It sounds like because like Michael introduces himself, he's like "I'm Michael," and the guy says, or he says, you know, Michael, or sticks his hand out or whatever, and the other guy says, "I'm Mike." So it just sounds like Mike, and I found that funny for a completely different reason because my brother's name is Michael, and he hates my mother for giving him the world's most popular name. Like when my Michael
was in
kindergarten.
It's not popular, it's classic.
Yes, that's her response. We have all had this battle many times with her. When Michael was in kindergarten, he was one of five Michaels in that kindergarten class. And the kindergarten teacher basically renamed all of them. They were like Michael, Mike, Mikey, Mickey, like all
and
of
Mick.
Them got like
dumbass.
A different kind of name or whatever. And Michael, when he got older, he was in college, he got his first email address. He set it to be Mr. Generic America. So because it's like everybody's name is Mike and Michael, especially in his age group. So when I heard him say Mike in the movie, I was like, oh, that's funny. That would annoy Michael for sure. Like that would like he would have been irritated by that having been introduced, you know, with people with his same name multiple times. But I will tell you that I can only give this movie the most classic of Kathleen compliments when it comes to it. And that is I fell asleep.
Well, it's only 20 minutes long, you goof.
I know. I made it to the point where Mike and Ike are at their very first party, and they start doing the kind of like speed blurring where Mike sits on the couch and the guys are like coming over and buying stuff from him or whatever. I fell asleep. So, in fairness, we watched the other movie first, and yes, it's not very long either, but we started late, and so I fell asleep.
Boo.
It's been a while since I did that.
That is true.
I figure it's a classic compliment.
Unforgivable.
I felt like.
How about you, Dave?
I liked it. I it seems like a classic sort of going into business story, except the business happens to be drugs. I mean, it's a popular theme. I mean, that they'd switch the drugs for candy as the illicit substance in question. I thought that was kind of a fun twist. I could definitely see the potential for there to be some social commentary here about illicit substances and like the war on drugs and GMOs and sugar and
government regulation, man.
Yeah, government regulation, manufactured, contrived
conspiracy theories,
manufactured demand for illicit substances. So, I mean, it is just interesting to put something that's not drugs into a drug context. I thought that was fun. It was interesting.
I liked that, too. I actually thought about that in the concept that, like, sugar. Like, I liked the idea that they picked sugar and wondered if the thought process behind it was the fact that, like, refined sugar is actually so terrible for you that like the government to air quotes finally step in and regulate something that is actually terrible for you, unlike other things that they regulate that aren't actually terrible for you, but it's a money grab, but we won't go there. You know, that it instantly becomes you know, this thing that we have to have. And I thought that that was cool, even though I didn't make it all the way through the movie. I liked that symbolism that they were doing. And I did see the candy gun, because that shows up early in the movie. So.
It does.
Though they're definitely starting out. There's like, because the first time he takes out the candy gun and he jams it in Michael's face, he jams it out so quick and it goes off screen. I'm like, what did he just do? And it's not until he pulls the gun back. I'm like, oh, he put his gun in his face that's got stripes on it. And I was like, so it's like, there's a couple of things I was like, okay, somebody needs to go in and go back there. But, because that's all that I can't help it when I'm watching these independent films. It's all I do is look for the mistakes. Everything. I'm like, what could you do different here? This is the feedback I would have for them. Because I am such a, you know, cinephile,
you've made so many,
indie,
and you've
yeah, exactly.
made so many movies.
Right. You know, in my extensive experience in the dog-eat-dog world that is filmmaking.
I admit that I do look for the mistakes myself, but I don't look for it as a way to dog the movie. I kind of look for them in ways like, because I get excited that people are doing something, like they're making something, and so I kind of think, like, oh, you could do this too, and you could also do that. Or you could block the shot this way, or you could have, you know, changed the delivery to be like this, so you could tweak the script to be like that. And it's not like, I mean, I've never made a movie. Wait. No, I've never made a movie.
Ew.
No, not that kind of movie. Wait. No, I've not filmed pornography, as I unintentionally implied. I may have produced pornography, but that is another story.
I mean, the Indiegogos are out the chart.
That's true.
They consider me a patron of the arts.
But no, I get excited when I see people doing something that's, especially something that they're really passionate about. And when I see stuff that people do, and I'm like, I just kind of want to, I don't know, it's not like nitpicking. It's just sort of like,
here's how I can help them. I could point this out, you know.
It's like you almost want to join in.
I do want to join in, or like it inspires you to make your own stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm. No, that would never happen.
I think that there's some good there's good storytelling elements that are very evident in this, and so I think that I think it's good. I think back to when I was in college, I had a friend that spent one summer making their own. They did like a noir detective movie kind of thing.
Oh, fun.
And one of the things that, like, in those things that you almost just can't help, one of their scenes took place in a Pizza Hut because they needed, like, it was supposed to be a bar, and so they were like meeting at the bar to have this meeting or whatever, and they picked this Pizza Hut because it was a dying franchise and it would be dark and lonely in there and they could do it during the day. And the waitress that, you know, because there were also a bunch of teenage boys, they were also going to eat while they were there. So they went ahead and ordered food and drinks, and the waitress comes over in the middle of the shot because she's paying no attention to what they're doing, or she gives no fucks one way or the other.
Yeah,
but it was still okay. Like, it worked, except she had one too many drinks because one was for the guy holding the camera.
Damn.
Like, she sets down all the glasses and then she like literally turns directly to the camera and then puts it down on the table and walks away. I mean, that was my favorite scene in the movie, which got me in trouble when I gave that feedback. I was like, what? It's okay. I mean, whatever. But
the fourth wall.
You know, it's that kind of thing that when you see somebody's made something and they're excited about it and they want to share it and they have this passion to go forward and do more, mm-hmm. you know, as they go on in their life, you get excited about that. And even though you see those extra glasses and errors or whatever, you almost want to tell them just because you want to help them because you want to see them succeed.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's not a way of tearing down, but more of a, this was so great. Yeah. You know, if you pulled the camera back a little bit farther, this wouldn't have happened, you know, that kind of thing. But
right. Like, it's, yeah, you see people who are, I mean, obviously more skilled at doing this than you are, but they are technically amateurs, and you're an amateur. You're like, oh yeah, and you want to participate, like you want to kind of be involved. But I enjoyed it. I think that the production quality was much higher than I was expecting it to be.
It really was. I thought the sound in particular was both the there was no post looping or ADR. They caught all of that live, and we've seen some movies where they're having a real tough. They're struggling with vocals.
They were listening to a podcast where they struggle with vocals
all the time. Shit, it took us 40 minutes to get this set up. the Foley was really good. I thought all the clicks and clacks and stomps and bumps were nice. The lighting was. We could see everything. And again, we've seen professional people do a much, I'm not going to name names, but we've seen some bad lighting in a lot of movies. And, and this was, we could see everything nice and clear without it being, you know, a spotlight on the actors. There was one really nice shot that I liked where, and it was just, it wasn't a very long shot, but, and I'm going to call it a long shot, where they were walking down a hall and it was one continuous shot for, oh, I don't know, about 30 seconds or so. And that was some cameraman or woman was walking backwards while this scene was happening. And I'm like, hey, that's pretty good. someone knows what they're doing. I bet that took quite a bit of time. And I just saw a movie called Climax where they had a...
Sorry.
Going like they had two... It was, you'd think.
Did you wish it was at the end of that movie?
But they had like 2 15-minute plus single shots going all over the place, and it was a thing of beauty. And I really love these long one shots because it's so hard to do. And even though this wasn't a very long one shot, but it was. It worked, and it worked very well, and I'm eager to see what else Calm can come up with as he progresses through his career.
Right. Those long shots, I mean, those are really challenging for experienced filmmakers.
Indeed,
with the best of equipment. So, like that, they would do something that ambitious. I think that's cool.
So, like, I'm curious to see where this goes next. I mean, like, it ends on this cliffhanger. Like, wait, what?
Yeah, I liked the cliffhanger. I wasn't expecting it. It was certainly a like, whoa, the door person is the door person working for the Fed?
Dude,
is the door person
man.
Is he working for the Fed? And she found out that he's a plant or something.
He's a narc, man.
Right. So that was a nice ending to, you know, hook you into part two of Candyland.
Candyland, part two, the Glucose Patrol. The Saccharin Squad.
So, good job, guys. Wonderful. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I cannot wait for part two. And if it comes out, we'll review it again, even if it's just a short segment on our regular cast. So, thanks a bunch. We really enjoyed it. How about we take another beer break and then we will jump into our feature short, Howl from Beyond the Fog.
The feature short.
I'm really, really curious what you guys have to think about this because I've got some stories about it.
I have a lot to say.
Excellent. So, well, let's grab this last beer and we'll see you in a few.
Who wants an orange whip? Orange whip? Orange whip? Three orange whips.
Okay.
It's kind of smelly.
Our second beer for the night is from Avery Brewing out in Boulder, Colorado. It is called Lilikoi Kapulo. It is... Hawaiian.
Yeah, it is.
It's a Hawaiian named beer, but is a Belgian style white ale. I love me some Belgian ales. I hope they make a comeback. It is 10 IBUs and 5.4%, so most of y'all are going to love this one. Not a hoppy beer at all. Belgian should have banana in it.
Oh, I immediately got a hit of banana as soon as I started.
Yeah, maybe
it.
maybe some bread. And it should have like a fluffy effervescence, like a real pillowy mouthfeel to it. I know. Fuck you all.
It's never not funny.
Creamy mouthfeel.
No, pillowy.
Should be pillowy in your mouth.
Pillows in your mouth.
There are certain things that are always just funny. Honking your horn at somebody when they walk in front of your car.
Startling them.
Pillowy mouthfeel. These are, they're always going to make me laugh. It's never not funny. I'm sorry.
This is really citrusy.
Yeah, it is.
Like, there's a lot of lemon and orange in this.
Yes, this is like...
That I wasn't expecting.
Very tropical.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wait. Speaking of tropical, duh. it's a Belgian beer with it has passion fruit in it also. So that's where the extra fun is coming from. Colorado made it. This would be great with like a barbecue.
That's what I'm tasting is coriander.
Okay, yeah, absolutely. Coriander, banana have kind of a lot of similar tasting notes, believe it or not.
I don't, because it doesn't taste anything like banana to me. It's like, I really like this. I need to slow down because I keep taking big drinks of it because I'm trying to like identify what it is, and I'm like, ooh, I'm gonna be a little loopy here. I don't know.
That's 5% beer. You'll be fine.
Yeah, I know.
The banana is in the nose.
Maybe if I poured it into a
banana
glass.
Banana nose.
Banana nose.
All I can smell is that tropical, that passion fruit.
That's, yeah.
And when I first like taste it, it's tart and it's juicy and it's got that fruit to it. And then the finish is this like weird, because it's not what I'm expecting, but not weird bad, mm-hmm, spice. And I was like, what in the hell? Like, it almost... I don't know. I literally have drank so many, like, I took so many so fast, now I'm going to have to, like, burp a lot, which is very inappropriate, so I'm trying not to belch in your ear.
You're going to get a brain freeze?
No, not that.
A beer brain freeze? That'd be terrible.
That would be terrible, but...
I love the can, too. It's got a wooden tribal mask.
Like
it's really...
Tiki god.
Wiki god.
Tiki.
Tiki. What'd I say?
Not a wiki.
You said wiki. Oh, it's not Wikipedia.
That's not what I meant.
It's a tiki god.
You know what? Drinking this beer, and it is definitely very well described, tropical, juicy, and tart. Like, I wonder if they were going for that flavor, or if they were just kind of experimenting, and then
surprise,
it ended up becoming like this. I mean, they're obviously trying for something like this with the passion fruit. But I don't know.
You don't think you could have done this on purpose? You had to accidentally stumble upon this flavor or something?
Sometimes that happens.
I'm sure.
This is a very good beer. This is a drinking beer.
Yeah, it's very enjoyable.
Man, this would be something to sit on the beach.
Mm-hmm.
After mowing
or not on the beach.
Drink some of this.
After mowing the lawn.
Yes.
After mowing the lawn. This is a lawn mowing beer.
I thought of you today, Dave, because I was mowing the lawn and it was hot. I was like, oh, I wish I had a nice, refreshing beer to have when I go in after doing this. I was like, that would be nice.
It is refreshing. It's a very long finish.
It is. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a Belgian beer, though. Like, wit beers hang in the mouth. I know.
Being all
pillowy. I know. Shut up. Damn it. The flavor lingers on the tongue. That's not any better, is it?
No. I mean, it's better than hanging in the mouth. That's kind of weird, but...
I think long finish is a proper term. So, yeah, it takes a long time for it to leave. It's not a dry beer. This is a... Very flavorful beer, and that passion fruit is, boy, that's the first thing that I.
Mm-hmm. It's very prominent.
Orange and lemon, kabloom and it's juicy in my mouth too.
Juicy, creamy, pillowy mouthfeel, hanging like pillows in your mouth.
Oh my god! Oh my god! I hate you all.
You just got to come up with a different phrase than
I just.
Come on.
You might as well just go straight for it. Like, it's a poopy, pee, jizzy mouthfeel.
Ew! No!
It's a juicy, not jizzy. It's juicy.
I'm totally cutting that out because that grossed me out as soon as I said it.
Yeah, that was bad. That was bad.
That might be an outtake.
All right. So, this movie.
Oh, Howl from Beyond the Fog.
Yes. I have something to say about this.
Oh, boy.
P, you really screwed the pooch with this movie.
I did?
Yeah. You want to know why? Because it is not a bad movie.
Oh.
This movie is beautiful.
Thank you.
This movie is phenomenal. And I know that we are not rating the movies, but if we were, this would be a zero for me.
Oh, I'm so happy.
If I turned on the TV and it was a lazy Saturday and I saw that this was on, I would stop and watch it again.
Oh, I'm so happy.
I was hoping. Loved this movie.
That is the most glowing endorsement and review of a movie I've ever heard you give on this podcast.
Mm. It's probably the only one that will ever happen that way, too. Complete and total shock. In complete and total fairness, as a boring-ass white girl from the Midwest, this is the first time I've seen a movie of this style. So I can't really speak to its quality as far as comparing apples to apples. But even if it is a low-rent version of this style of film, it is a hell of an entrance to watching this style of film. My literal only critique was, if I understood the story right, the two main characters are cousins and maybe going off to live together in holy matrimony at the end, which was a little but... That's also for 1909, when the movie is supposed to be taking place. Mm-hmm. Not that out of the, realm of acceptability. So I'm going to leave it there. But it's also very possible that I just did not understand if they were. Because I honestly could not tell for a long time if they were or were not siblings. Because of the, or not siblings, but cousins. Because the movie is subtitled.
Mm-hmm.
And we were starting so late, and even though the movie was very short, it was the first one of the three things that we watched.
Mm-hmm.
And if it had been earlier in the evening, I would have paused more to take notes. But with subtitles, I'm trying to take notes and read and watch at the same time. And so I'm sure that my confusion literally came from the looking up and down and trying to do these three things at the same time, which was not a smart choice. But yeah, I really, really enjoyed this movie.
I'm so happy. I am so very happy because I also love this film. Yeah. There's a lot to digest. That is a deep story. And I've got some stories, but I'd like to hear what Dave and Troy have to think also before I get into some background stuff.
Troy first.
I liked it.
You are so a man of few words today.
It was very pretty. It's a very pretty film. It's got a lot of atmosphere. It takes its time getting there.
Sure.
And it was late, and I was like, all right, you got to speed it up a little bit. But the design on it is gorgeous. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah. We were talking a little bit earlier today because I told Troy that I liked this movie. And I told him, I was like, don't say anything to them that I liked this movie, because I wanted to kind of like
spring it on
basically
you.
Make you think I was going to rip you an asshole for it. And then just kinda, be like, just kidding. I loved it. So,
not an asshole. I already have one of those.
A new one. So get the Fuggler after you. But we talked a little bit about sound, and that would probably be my only one other critique is the monster roar. I loved the idea of what they did with that. And this isn't specific to this genre of movie or anything. It's just a, it's a pet peeve of mine that when there's massive action of explosions or crashes or a monster or anything in a movie where when the action ramps up, the volume goes up, that drives me fucking bananas. Like, it takes me out of the movie because I'm constantly like, turn it up to hear the people, turn it down to dull the roar, literally. And so I did have to tell Troy to turn it down because we were watching it. Millie's in bed, and the movie wasn't super loud until the monster would roar, and then it just felt like my house was being shaken down. So
there was actually
we have to turn this down.
Yeah, there was actually one scene where it was just like probably 5 to 6 sustained seconds of the monster just roaring like for like and I was like okay, I'm done, okay, I get it.
Which was cool. It was musical almost, the way that the monster roared, which I liked. That sound equalizing thing irritated me.
Did it remind you guys of a foghorn?
A little bit, yep.
I wonder if that was.
It had that honking resonance.
Honking resonance.
My descriptors are terrible today. Anyway.
No, they're good. I listened to a true crime podcast where, when somebody would say something like that, one of the hosts would repeat it, and they go, "That's my drag name," and so that keeps like flipping through my head. When you're like a honking resident, I'm like honking resident. That's my drag name.
That's a good bit. I like that.
Like, that's totally their shtick, but it, like, I've literally started hearing things that people say in that bit inside my head because I've binged so much of it lately.
You know what? I think we could do that too. Our bit could be either recontextualizing what people say into law firm names or band names. Like, what was it? What'd you say? Honking Resonance.
Honking Resonance.
That's a great garage band name. Yes. Yeah,
Honking
sure.
Resonance and the Creamy Mouth Feels.
Shit.
Yeah. Welcome to the stage, Pillowy Mouth Feel.
Special guest, Honking Resonance.
Yeah.
I really liked the movie. I wasn't sure what to expect. I knew that it was going to be like in the tradition of the like Japanese bunraku sort of puppetry, and so that's I was thinking, okay, well, I mean, I wasn't quite sure what that was going to be like because I know in that tradition there's usually like a couple of puppeteers and like one person playing like music accompaniment, and so I wasn't sure if this is going to be like, you know, Thunderbirds Argo or something like that,
which would be awesome.
Like marionettes and whatnot. But as I was watching it, like the first thing I noticed, like, wow, these miniatures are beautiful. Hmm. These sets are beautiful. And the first time you see a glimpse of the monster, and I don't think it was ever named in the movie.
It has a name, but Nebula. It wasn't named in the movie. Yes.
Yes.
Correct.
The first time we ever get a glimpse of it, I'm like, ooh, that's kind of cool. And then when we finally see it, like, full on, I'm like, that's a really cool... That's a really cool figure. And then it kind of dawned on me, like, no, that's a suit. Like, somebody's wearing that. Like, that's
there's
really
a dude
neat.
In there.
And as far as, like, creature suits go, like, that was a good one. And go ahead.
Oh, I got lots of background. So if you want, I'm going to start steering this ship if you have one more thing to say.
Okay. Well, there was conversation within, like, in the show, in the movie, the short, whatever we're calling it, the film. And I noticed that there were some parallels to other similar movies like Princess Mononoke, where there's an environmental aspect to it, and like the disturbing of nature, the disturbing of nature. I almost said natural and nature, and I just said nature.
Nature.
Like I'm from upstate New York.
Welcome to the stage, Nature.
but like the because I mean, it was set in 1909, which is like sort of like the Meiji Reformation period. I mean, it wasn't that long before that that Japan was still in its feudal period.
Yes.
Like in the late 1800s. And so there was a lot of industrialization, a lot of changes environmentally. And like this, the story of some sort of natural creature being kind of evicted or destroyed as industry rolls along and with the advancement of the modern world. It's a common story in Japan, I think. And I thought that this was a great take on it and done in a novel way. I liked it. The only thing I really had a problem with was one, what we had mentioned before, with that roar, like that was deafening. And the subtitles were a little off. Like I noticed.
They were a couple, were a couple places where I was like,
they were delayed and then they tried to catch up. And
yeah. Well, the translation was actually off. So there was some grammatically incorrect things.
Oh, yes. Yes, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. Whatever. There was one part where in the very beginning, when Eiji first finds the blind girl.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not when he first finds her. It's when she like tells him the story of how she came to live where she lived.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of it, she makes the comment, or she says the line, I'm not supposed to be dead.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, wait. She is supposed to be dead. She's not supposed to be dead. I don't understand.
Supposed to be dead. Like, I think she's supposed to be dead, yeah.
That was confusing, and which I was like, okay, I'm just not understanding what's happening yet.
Mm-hmm.
But then later there was another, like, much more clear mistake in the translation that made me go, oh, okay, we're having some translation issues. I think that not was not supposed to be there.
Right.
And she is supposed to be dead.
She's supposed to be dead.
Especially because I kind of grasped the story a little more.
She was locked away. Anyway, yeah. I'm sorry.
That one definitely threw me for a loop, because as soon as she said that, and I saw the subtitles, and it said, I'm not supposed to be dead. Like, I'm like, oh, wait, is this hell or heaven?
That's what
dead?
I thought, like, too. I'm like...
Mm.
Like,
right.
Is this all
that's
purgatory?
A great point, yeah.
Like, is everybody in the island in purgatory? Sorry, that was a Lost reference.
Yeah. They weren't in purgatory, though.
Yeah.
They weren't.
Or whatever it was.
They were knocking on heaven's door.
I know we're tiptoeing around what this movie is, like, what the story is. And it's a story... I really would like our listeners to search for it. I guess. I mean, Kathleen loves it, so we got that going for us. it's well worth looking up, so I don't want to spoil it too much. But it's kind of a story about a monster and their caretaker, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I think that's as far as I'm going to go with the story and the plot. So I highly recommend looking for this. We got an advanced copy because we're Kickstarter funders. This is supposed to be out later this year.
Kickstarter
funder. Just look for it. Howl from Beyond the Fog. It is well worth the 38 minutes that you will spend watching it.
Mm-hmm.
So this film, I had to email the cast and tell you that this is a puppet theater film in case you started watching it and went, the fuck is this? Because quite frankly, when I saw a screening, a short screening of it at G-Fest, that's exactly what we did. We went, well, wait a minute. I've put my money down for a movie, mm-hmm. and you're showing me puppets. And after the director was there and the suit director or the suit maker was there, and those were some of the first questions, were, is this movie about puppets? And that's the director said, oh yeah, this is a traditional Japanese style of art. And the room, a bunch of gaijin in the room going, huh? But we had no idea that this was a traditional theatrical entertainment outlet in Japan. So what this is called Bunraku. And it's been around since the late 16th century. And it takes a lot of stylizing from the Kabuki theater. It takes decades to be a master puppeteer. And I'm not kidding when I've read a bunch of things where it takes 10 years on the left leg, 10 years on the right leg, 10 years on the arm, and then so on and so forth. So it takes, much like anything in Japan, it takes a very long time.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, this sounds very Japanese.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, the movie felt very Japanese. Like, the when they kind of would stop have, like, philosophical musings upon the meanings of life in the middle of a conversation. It's like, oh, man, how many anime have I watched that had this feel, you know?
Sure, yeah. So it is a fascinating style. I recommend anyone looking up Bunraku, B-U-N-R-A-K-U, on YouTube, and just briefly skimming a few things. I don't expect anybody to be an expert of this, but if you look it up, it's a beautiful theatrical style, unlike anything that America has to offer. It blows Punch and Judy out of the water, just to be frank. James May actually did an improv Bunraku performance on an episode of Amazon Prime show James May, Our Man in Japan, which is another very that was a lot of fun. That 6-episode series on Amazon Prime was a hoot. So, and he what he does with the puppets is quite funny. So going on to the director was Daisuke Sato.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, Daisuke Sato.
No, Daisuke is pretty close.
I'm working. I don't have a lot of information on him as a director. He did direct a short called The Foghorn, which is a salute to a Ray Bradbury short story called The Foghorn. He did this in 2007. There is a trailer on YouTube, but the whole movie is not available anywhere. I think he just kind of made it as a fan. It's very much 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, if you've seen that.
That's where Disney film?
No, I'm saying 20,000 Fathoms. I'm so sorry.
Oh, okay.
The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. I said that wrong. I said that wrong.
I know, so Jules there's a lot wrote that, but Disney did a good exception.
Right. Ray Bradbury wrote. Anyway.
Right, we're mixing things up.
So outside of those two shorts, this one, Howl from Beyond the Fog, and The Foghorn, outside of that, he is more of a special effects guy on a number of kaiju films in recent history, especially in the 80s and 90s.
Okay.
More like 90s and 2000s. Anyway. Now, the suit maker. Now, this guy is fascinating. And I got to meet him in G-Fest, was that 19? 18 or 19, I forget. And G-Fest is the Godzilla convention in Chicago every year, which sadly is canceled this year, but that's okay. We'll pick it up next year. Kaizu Murase. Now, Murase-san is a suit designer and has been a suit designer since the golden age of the Kaiju Iga. In the 1960s, he started making Kaiju suits. So he has, what would that be, 50-plus years, 60-plus years of suit-making experience? So he made this monster from scratch, with foam rubber and all sorts of wonderful things. He was not the suit actor because he's in his 70s. but it is his hand that made this beastie. He is credited with making suits for King Ghidorah, Mothra, Gamera, and Titanosaurus. And a few of those names, some of you out there in the void might know. He also worked at the special effects supervisor on one of Good Beer, Bad Movie Nights lost episodes of the Mighty Peking Man. He made the ape suit for that.
Oh, the Mighty Peking
Man. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So it was the 2018 G-Fest that he was at. So Murase-san brought some of his prop, he brought some replica props from his films. So I was able to see a King Ghidorah and a Mothra head. They were props, but he had actually made them because being 50 years old, these things deteriorate.
Mm-hmm.
So he had remade them in the likeness of what they were. There was even a piece of suit skin, I suppose you could say, that had survived from Varan the Unbelievable from 1958. So part of that suit survived those many years, and he was able to bring it to show it to us, and that was really neat. I'm like, wow, that's from the actual suit from 1958 that has that little section had survived all the years of wear and tear. The one funny thing about Murase-san was he came out of the cosplay room. There's a cosplay changing room where people go in there and are have privacy and are able to put on their costumes and come out and parade around the convention. And he went in there and he put on his Mighty Peking suit.
Oh my gosh.
And paraded around the dealer room.
Oh my God. Oh.
And he was hamming it up. Like he was aping it up, I suppose. Is that the right word? Now, I don't know 100% if that was the original suit, because that suit was like in the 70s. I don't know if the original survived, but it was a fabulous reproduction, and it made me laugh every time I saw him walk by. I'm like, oh yeah, I should have asked him to give me the finger.
That's ape.
Oh my God.
Oh, that's ape. Is that ape?
That's ape.
Oh, shit.
That is ape.
That is ape. Damn it. See, I'm getting
why you didn't ask him to give you the finger.
I'm getting my monkey movies mixed up.
Our lost monkey movies.
And let me
movies.
Tell you, that's a mouthful. Monkey movies mixed up.
The words
welcome to the stage. Monkey movies.
The words get caught in your throat.
Troy and I should do a...
that's hilarious.
We should do an encore one of these days, Troy.
Yes.
So, Kathleen, I 100% agree with you that this movie was beautiful. The Foley was good. The acting was great. The puppets, the human puppets, were haunting.
Mm-hmm.
They were creepy and beautiful all at the same time. The miniatures, the houses that were. stomped on, I suppose. Everything was just wonderful.
That's actually one of the other, I hesitate to call it a criticism, but one of those things that I did notice, like in the old kaiju movies, or actually any of the movies where, like Ultraman or any of the Godzilla movies, when they're going around just stomping on buildings and whatnot, like those buildings are meticulously created to be destroyed in the way that a full-scale building would be destroyed.
Hmm.
And the buildings that were destroyed in this movie, they looked a little sturdier. And, like, they looked like they were built to be beautiful and not necessarily destroyed. So they didn't quite...
break apart,
get
right?
Get demolished. Yeah, yeah, they didn't break apart in the way that you would expect in, like, one of the older kaiju movies. That's the only...
Yeah.
I noticed it. It was just, like, one of those little things. I'm like, oh, well, I mean, I don't really care, but... like, oh, okay. I mean, it kind of takes you out just a little bit. Like, okay, that is a guy in a suit stomping on, like, a cardboard box.
I see what you're saying. And I agree with you. The one, like, different way to look at it would be in the, at least the movies that you guys have made me watch where they're crumping around on things. They're stomping around in, like, a downtown area
mm-hmm.
where the buildings are more made of, like, stone or granite or brick, and this was like a small village
mm-hmm.
so the mm-hmm. buildings were more timber and the
right.
like the sliding doors with like the paper
mm-hmm.
Insets or what have you, so I feel like they would crunch and demolish differently, but in that same way, I do know what you're saying, because there were a couple times where, like, he did step on the building, and it was like the top just fell down and the sides smashed out, and it's like, what? No, those timber should crack at the weight of, like, this thing stepping on it, and, like, so I get what you're saying, but at the same time, that wasn't that big of a distraction for me in comparison to those films, because the setting was so different in that they were in a mountainside country village versus a city.
Yeah, and I get it. And like I said, it's just one of those little things. It is a nitpick.
Yeah.
So we can sort of, I don't know, do you have more to say?
Well, I was just going to ask, like, how small or independent is this film company that made this movie? Like, we know Christopher Mim is, you know, has his kind of little universe there in Minnesota where, you know,
it's a Mimiverse, damn you.
I'm sorry, excuse me. You know, where he's got, you know, he's got his thing going on and, you know, what his general budgets are, kind of thing. And then the Minotaur movie that we watched, we know that was like a passion project paid for out of pocket with this guy and what have you. This felt, and maybe it was just for sheer fact that it was this specific style of filmmaking, the puppetry and a foreign language film, that I would not have been surprised if you had told me this was not an independent film.
Oh.
You know what I mean? But again, I'm not familiar with this style at all. So, you know, I could, you know, conceivably see a movie that is professionally made in this style and be like, oh, yeah, that other one was a piece of crap. But I doubt that.
It's actually a skill in Japanese filmmaking that they can take something with a little budget and then with what resources they have, tell a really compelling story. Like, if you take anime, like, the tradition of anime is started back, like, in, I don't know, like, the 40s or 50s or something like that, and where there wasn't a lot of money to buy animation cells, where they would paint one and then another and another. Mm-hmm. So instead of trying to articulate all the mouth movements, they would just have a mouth going open and closed. And, like, the way that they would imply motion, instead of moving a character through a space, they would move the space around the character. So there's one cell, but the background is moving. And I think this movie actually used some of those sort of economical storytelling techniques where they would have a single shot of, let's say, a three-quarter profile of the female character and with a little bit of wind blowing, and then having the voice actor's performance add to that. And then it, like, that performance would shine through with that sort of moody atmospheric feel to it.
Right.
And so you kind of forget that it's, you know, a wooden puppet that doesn't have an articulated mouth.
Right.
And I think that's a skill that Japanese filmmakers have more than, I'd say, than a lot of other filmmakers.
Right.
Sorry, that was just my take on budget and the resourcefulness.
No, I think that is poignant and makes sense. And I think that's part of what, like, makes the movie seem more high budget and stylized, is because they weren't trying to move the puppet mouth up and down. Mm-hmm. Like, that would have taken away from
the quality
look of it. That, it would have taken it from this kind of artistic piece of film work to something goofy.
Thunderbirds are gone.
Right. And that's not part of the style of Bunraku.
Exactly.
Bunraku is, this is very much just ripped right out of that theatrical style. It's those plain faces, those plain white faces, and the extravagant garments, and the puppeteers wear, much like any other good puppeteers performing in a theater, will wear all black,
right?
And they'll just Man, it's really cool. If you get a chance, and I'm not saying go deep dive, but if you get a chance, just watch a few minutes of it on YouTube somewhere. Mm-hmm. It's really neat. Just really neat. You'll get what you need in a few minutes of of watching it.
Cool. I would do that.
Excuse me.
Bless you.
So, I know Dave kind of talked about how it is that they're able to stretch their budget, but is this film company, like, is it like Christopher Mim, where it's just one dude who's doing these passion projects, or is it a small company that's making these movies? And do they make more like this one, or do they do all kinds of different styles?
As far as I know, this movie got made because Kaizu Murase and Murase-san and Sato-san wanted to make a movie, and Murase-san wanted to make a new suit. So they got together and they came up with a story, and they got it funded through Kickstarter, and they found a production company called Los Gatos. Is that,
yeah,
was that the
cats,
which was yeah, weird, but whatever. That production company was able to bring everything together, and that's all I know about it. I didn't do that deep of a dive. So,
I mean, that answers my question. It's a guy who wanted to make a movie.
It's a couple of guys that wanted to make a movie. Yeah.
It's a guy who wanted to make a movie versus a small company that's trying to get off the ground.
No, I don't know that. Maybe this company is trying to get off the ground.
Moving forward, having their partnership be successful, they may go, hey, we should do more of this. But at the onset, it was a dude who wanted to make a movie.
Yeah. Yeah. And God bless him for it, because it's marvelous.
It really is so beautiful.
If it is ever available widespread, you folks got to go see this. It is a work of art. So I guess we all agree that these are three films, or three shorts, I should say, worth finding. Is that, do we have three home runs here for folks to go out and check out?
I think that each was enjoyable in its own way. I mean, in a very different way. So, I mean,
for its,
one might be awesome to you, while another may not be your cup of tea.
Well, that's with anything, for sure. But I don't know if we could agree that, and maybe not. Maybe we can't agree that they're all great. I think they're all worth the time that you would spend watching them. Which is not a lot of time. I mean,
combined.
If you don't like it, it's over quick.
Yeah, like it, I mean, it was 35 minutes out of your day. I mean,
right.
Yeah.
So, thank you to the creators, Mark, Colm, and Murase-san. Thank you for sharing your passions, your talents, and your skills with us. I hope that in some little way, this podcast can get the word out and others can see what you have done and bring joy to other people's lives, as you have brought joy to mine. With that said, Kathleen, how can people get a hold of us?
You can email us. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us on Twitter. Yeah, that's how you can find us. Yeah, that's how you can find us. I've said all the names and letters multiple times and screwed them up 1,000 times. You know how to get a hold of us. So,
would it be GBBMN podcast?
For the most part, yeah.
Or you could look us
at gmail.com.
Yep. Or you could look us up on Facebook at Good Beer Bed Movie Night.
There you go.
It's Troy's job from now on. That
was
delightful.
It's Troy's job from now on.
So, next month is August, so we're going to wrap up the summer with a summer blockbuster?
Yeah.
Superhero
maybe.
Movie?
A not-so-super superhero
movie. Well said.
Uh-huh. That's actually the best way. That's going to be the poll, Troy. So Troy's going to put up a poll, the not-so-super-superhero movie, and we're going to let you, the listener, pick what film you want us to review. And we are coming up with exactly what those films are, but it'll be up very shortly on our Facebook page. So please go there or go to our website, goodbeerbadmovienight.com or podcast. Is it the whole fucking thing?
It's goodbeerbadmovienight.com.
That's what I have.
Oh, shit.
Or if you type in gbbmn.com, it takes you to the site as well.
Oh, look at you.
So that's what we're just say that from now on.
gbbmn.com.
Fantastic. So we'll let you know on the Facebook for sure, the Twitter and the Instagram, that you'll need to go to the website to go ahead and vote for the not-so-super-superhero movie for August. And until next time...
This is a movie that I'd actually watch again.
I've never heard you say that.
I know.
Okay. Well, we'll start over here, Dave.
No, you can just
right. I'll just come in.
Oh, wait. Was that you trying to mimic the sound of a beer opening with your mouth? I can see the potential for there to be some. I could see the potential for the fuck my butt.
I had to get two beers because Kathleen said she had a lot to say.
I like this beer. Mm-hmm. This is good. This Lake Erie Love.
Yeah, I like this too. Troy, you never went and got us the second beer.
Shit.
Yeah. That is very much my life at times.
Troy doesn't bring you your beer either.
I have another clap in me if you'd like it, sir.
Oh, by the way, I've been getting a lot of mileage out of the family rag thing that you brought to my attention, which is kind of gross and awesome.
What? And I'm sorry, I had to include it.
What are you laughing at?
I'm sorry. I'm looking at the Catawba Island Brewing Company's Facebook page, and I'm clicking through, and it says, a holiday history lesson from your friends at CIBC. And it shows a picture of mayonnaise. It says, most people don't know that back in 1912, Hellman's mayonnaise was manufactured in England. In fact, the Titanic was carrying 12,000 jars of the condiment scheduled for delivery in Veracruz, Mexico, which was to be the next port of call for the great ship after its stop in New York. This would have been the largest single shipment of mayonnaise ever delivered to Mexico. But we all know what happened. The Mexican people loved mayonnaise so much, and this loss was so devastating that the Mexican people declared a national day of mourning, which happens every year on the day the shipment was supposed to arrive. This day, of course, is the 5th of May, or more commonly known as the Cinco de Mayo.
Oh my god.
S-I-N-K-O.
Boo. I was like, that is horseshit.
The Cinco de Mayo.
So should we find a mayonnaise movie to watch next year?
They took that so far to tell that joke.
That was great. That was a great joke.
That's why I was laughing.
So, it's fun in my head.